This is work in progress, and it's also, how can I say this? It's illustrative of things, and I wouldn't want to claim that what I'm doing has direct application to the sun, but I think it's part of a... Yes, it's not working. What's going on? It's making noise and I blew into it. I turned it off by mistake. Green light. Try that. Yep. Are we all right now? Okay. In Cambridge, we spent a lot of time trying to understand the interaction of convection with magnetic fields. In the old days, when we had little computers, we looked at incompressible convection, which clearly has no application, no direct application to the sun. We are now able to do three-dimensional simulations and compressible atmospheres. We're still not at a stage where we can produce quantitative agreement, but we're able now to do simulations that may perhaps resemble a chunk of the photosphere. And one of the things we're interested in is the way in which magnetic fields select the scale of convection. So, let's say that we have intermittency, as you all know. Sorry, this first one was written for a non-astrophysical audience. Sunspots and pores on the one hand and small-scale network fields on the other. How do the magnetic fields interact with the convection? And, of course, both the kinematics and the dynamics are important. And we could, as many have done, Nordlund, Brandenburg and others, try to put in everything, or as much as possible, which is extremely good if you can do it. We don't feel we're competent to understand such models. We like to put in bits of the problem and to try and do as thorough a job as we can on the small pieces that we're dealing with. So as I say, I make no pretense that what we are doing here represents all the physics of the sun. What we're going to do and what I'm going to tell you about are numerical simulations of compressible convection in the presence of a magnetic field in a layer of perfect gas. So that's what we're actually going to do. We take a layer which is, well, I have some statements about it here. So we have a basic state, which is a horizontal layer. Not very much board on this side. I could draw it behind. So that's very simple. Simply a layer which is vertical, gravity is downwards. Is that tautologist? Gravity. and there is an imposed, before you start, there's an imposed vertical magnetic field, uniform. And this is in some way heated from below, and heat comes out at the top. And as I say, the initial state is a uniformly stratified solution, the linear temperature profile. So we have a polytrope with some polytropic index, and we then have the temperature and the density given in terms of the depth. And we have a super adiabatically stratified layer, and so the layer is unstable, and we will have convection. Now, one can make lots of assumptions. We have a compressible medium about the conductivities and diffusivities and so on, and this is what we have done. You may say this is what I'm going to show you depends very crucially on these assumptions, and that may be true, and I just don't know the answer to that. But anyway, I want to point out that the shear viscosity mu is taken to be constant in this calculation. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, I use a pointer. Yeah. Thank you. Is that all right? The shear viscosity mu is taken to be constant, and the heat capacity and the electrical conductivity are taken to be constant. Again, this is not this cannot be justified on physical grounds, but only for essentially for comparison with earlier computations that had uniform density. So you have constant magnetic diffusivity, but thermal diffusivity and viscous diffusivity decreasing with depth. So the layer is more viscous at the top than it is at the bottom in terms of the usual kinematic viscosity. And this makes computation easier, but may have an effect on what we actually see in the simulations. So I do put that caveat in. I have a constant Prandtl number. An important parameter when we're discussing the interaction of magnetic fields and convection is the ratio between the thermal diffusivity and the thermal conductivity and the magnetic diffusivity. And this depends on the density, and so increases with depth. This is appropriate in sunspots. We're going to model sunspots and model the kappa by some sort of radiative term. Meyer and others have shown it's appropriate to think of zeta increasing through unity with depth. But in fact, this is what we do. We account for this increase simply by this artifact. And the crucial quantity is the value of zeta at the mid-level, which in the simulations I'm going to show you is just above 1. So in fact, at the top of the layer, zeta is less than 1, and at the bottom of the layer, zeta is greater than 1. That's the situation we're going to study. And very quickly, I'll flash this up just to show we know what the equations are that we're solving. I'm not sure there's very much here I want to explain to you, except perhaps the boundary conditions. I just say we have perfect gas law, continuity, no monopoles, induction equation, momentum equation, and heat equation. And these have been used, nothing new in these, and what we've used for years and what others have used also. The magnetic boundary conditions, we have assumed that the magnetic field is vertical at the top and bottom of the layer, and that fluid does not flow out of the system. Now, I think from the point of view of understanding convection in the photosphere, maybe the velocity boundary condition is not a good one. As far as I'm concerned, magnetic boundary conditions, we want to make as little assumption as possible about what goes on outside the computational domain, and this is computationally convenient and doesn't force one to make statements about what is going on outside. We've tried alternative boundary conditions in various cases. There are not enormous differences when we change the magnetic boundary conditions. Some of our runs have fixed temperature boundaries. Some others have a radiative boundary condition. In fact, the movie, which I'm going to show you, radiative boundary conditions. Again, it doesn't matter a great deal. And the important numbers that will characterize what is going on in this layer, apart from the aspect ratio, so we have an aspect ratio of lambda, which is the periodic direction. All our computations are in square, with square planform. And the relative, the size, the horizontal extent is lambda times the vertical extent of the layer. And we have periodic boundary conditions in the two horizontal directions. So that's one important parameter is lambda. In fact, it's very important to have lambda large enough, as you might expect, to mimic events in a very large region. And there are two other parameters which we're going to vary. In fact, we're not going to vary R very much. R is the Rayleigh number, which essentially is the degree of superdiabaticity. And Q is proportional to the square of the imposed field. So, R is proportional to delta minus delta add, and Q is proportional to B naught squared. So large Q, large field, large R, vigorous convection. And we choose these parameters for sigma and the midplane value of zeta. You can see there are many dimensionless parameters. In the particular atmosphere that we're going to discuss, the density contrast is 11 between the top and the bottom. So it's reasonably stratified. But that does mean that it's 11 times more viscous at the top than at the bottom. Well, we've been running simulations in relatively small boxes for some time, and it's quite clear that we can't get away with only moderately wide boxes. If we try to do our simulations in smaller boxes, we find that the solutions are heavily constrained by the periodic boundary conditions in the horizontal. And that can be seen from these pictures. So now here is an example of very ordered convection at relatively low Rayleigh number. I should explain what you're seeing here. This is the computational domain, correctly rendered in terms of its aspect ratio. So this is it's more than two, it's 8/3, I think. This distance is 8/3 of this distance, for historical reasons. What you see here, the arrows everywhere represent the fluid velocity. The color on this top, this is the top of the layer, and this is the bottom of the layer, which has been detached so you can see it. The color here represents magnetic field strength, so that the red represents weak field and the blue stronger field, and same here, the same color table here. On the sides, the color represents temperature. So these are hot regions here and cold regions here. So you're not looking into the domain, you're looking at the edge of the box. I find this easier to understand than trying to look inside. And it's the same here. So these are two different problems, and I think the Rayleigh number increases between them. Should explain that I came without some of my material. I had to download pictures in a hurry, and so I'm sorry I don't have a notation here. But you can see here that the system, because of the asymmetry of the system between up and down, it's well known that hexagonal cells are favored close to onset. Now this is a square box actually, so you can't fit a hexagonal array into this box, but it does a jolly good job, in fact. With this aspect ratio, if you get the right angle for your lattice, you can achieve almost a hexagonal lattice with the error of only 1 or 2%. Very, very easy to do. And as you increase, various things happen as you increase the heating, but you still have a regular pattern, but in fact some more symmetry is broken. You can see there's less symmetry here than there is here. There's some evidence of organization in this direction, which is different from the organization in that direction. But I don't want to discuss these matters. What you see here is what happens near onset, and in fact if you have small boxes, you always see a regular pattern until it breaks down into something much more disordered. This is an even narrower box. And so the ones you're looking at, these are steady. This is steady, and this is now it's time dependent here. These are two snapshots from the same run. It starts off steady, always starts off steady, and then there are various, in small boxes, there are various complicated instabilities that break certain symmetries of the pattern, which, again, in my view, are artifacts of the box size and have nothing to do with what goes on in a big box. But you see here, symmetrical, less symmetrical, but still steady. And then this becomes time-dependent. And what happens in these small boxes is that for sufficiently large Rayleigh number at a fixed Q, you get vigorous time-dependent motion with very wide cells in the box. So essentially, there are two cells here, but really there's one big one. Left this for longer, you probably just have one cell in that periodic box. So an infinite array of cells with the largest possible horizontal scale permitted by the size of the computational domain. And of course, then you worry that if you made your box wider, then you would get even wider cells. And indeed, when the let me show you the bottom one here, you do indeed get wider cells when you have wider boxes. It's necessary to go to boxes with aspect ratio at least 4 to be sure that the size of your convection cell is not determined by the periodic boundary conditions. So this is 4 by 4. And you can see one enormous cell, but in fact there are other bits of motion involved here. It's a slightly smaller cell. This is all very vigorously time dependent, as you'll see in the movie that I'm going to show you. But there's evidence here, and this is really what I want to focus on. There's some evidence here that there are two kinds of convection going on. There's this wide, very vigorous convection involving strong horizontal outflows and very wide cells here. And the field is pushed away, and all the field is in these interstitial regions here. On the other hand, there are some evidence of a smaller scale between these big cells. You see it more clearly here, where you have one big cell and a lot of smaller ones. The distinction isn't very clear-cut here. You can see it again here. So two big cells, but a lot of little ones. And you wonder whether there's more than one way in which the convection can organize itself. And indeed, there's some evidence that, there is evidence which I'm going to present to you, that this is true, that in sufficiently wide boxes and in the right parameter range, you can have a coexistence between two different sorts of motion. One, vigorous, with wide, large horizontal aspect ratio, expelling all the magnetic field. And on the other hand, small horizontal length scale, not as vigorous, with the field not so expelled, and in fact controlling the horizontal scale of the flow. It's well known in theoretical studies of magnetoconvection that if you have a strong field, a very strong field, then the optimum form of convection at onset has very small horizontal scale, which decreases as Q increases. And you might expect that to persist to moderate a Rayleigh number, which indeed it does. But once the system breaks out and gets rid of the flux and pushes it into the exterior, it can then convect, pretending there's no magnetic field at all. So there's another possibility. You can get rid of some of the field and proceed on your merry way. And the question is really, who wins this battle and when? That's what I want to talk about. So just to recap. So in the small boxes, you either have regular patterns or disordered flow. And again, we don't really know what the length scale of these structures is. When Q is very small, so essentially negligible, the field has no dynamical effect, then the scales of this of the motion become quite large. Horizontal dimensions of the order of 4 times the layer depth, which is much wider than the linearized calculations. If you do the linear stability problem for this atmosphere, then you discover that the horizontal length scale is much smaller than that. So it's a nonlinear effect, nonlinear movement to these wide cells, which is not fully understood. And indeed, in two dimensions, there are unpublished calculations by Hurlbut, who tells me that he, a long time ago, solved the non-magnetic convection problem with an atmosphere of this kind in two-dimensional motion, and found cells getting longer and longer and wider in the nonlinear regime until he finally stopped the computation. So in the two-dimensional case, it's not clear whether there is, in fact, any upper limit. In the three-dimensional case, it does seem clear that the increase in the width of these cells does stop, which is encouraging because you don't want to feel that everything you do is determined by your horizontal boundary conditions. So, encouraged by these simulations for aspect ratio 4, we continued and did more for aspect ratio 8. So this is becoming a bit heavy in terms of supercomputer time. We're very fortunate to have essentially a dedicated supercomputer at Cambridge, which we have a large percentage of the time. So we've done a large number of simulations for wide boxes of aspect ratio 8, and I'll show you one or two, and then the movie is in fact devoted to that. Yes. The flux itself. I think he's interested in the horizontal scale of the magnetic field compared to the layer depth. Is that right? Is that your question? Well, here, this is where the tubes are. There are no tubes. There are local tubes. I mean, but this scale here is a typical scale, horizontal scale for the magnetic field structures. Well, you can see at the bottom it looks rather different. It is very complex. Yeah. It's certainly different at the bottom. But I think you could follow the structure down. It's very. You can see here, for example, where you get a cut of it at the side, But there is a coherent temperature field, at least goes halfway down the layer. But what goes out here must come in somewhere else, and so the topology is quite different at the bottom. But it's more interesting to look at the top. Yes, so the horizontal scale of the magnetic field structures is influenced by the local value of the magnetic diffusivity. So there's an implied magnetic Reynolds number, which is determined by the vigor of the convection, and this scales like the 1/2 power of that magnetic Reynolds number. So it's small compared to the horizontal scale and small compared to the layer depth, in fact. Magnetic Reynolds numbers here are the order of 100 or 150, something like that. Not very large. It's a combination in our case. I'm sure it's principally a combination. It's a balance between diffusion and advection towards the stagnation point. There is significant magnetic pressure effects also. So these regions here have lower density, quite lower density. In fact, we had some trouble with negative density in some of our runs. So that aspect of the Lorentz force, the magnetic pressure aspect, is indeed important in these calculations as well. They're all about the same order. You can't say that diffusivity is a minor thing. That's another problem with comparing this to the sun. But here are these wide boxes. No, you get the right way around. Okay, so here is a very pretty picture of this. So this is an 8x8x1 simulation. And again, you see, this is for small q. So essentially, for a case in which the magnetic field doesn't do anything, and all the magnetic field is tied up in these little regions here, and there are large cells which come and go. I mean, they're very time dependent, as you'll see in the video. But at any one time, you see a number of these big cells, and the field is essentially squeezed out into the interstitial region. In this simulation, the heat flux is proportional to the temperature to the 4th power. It does vary point by point. I have to take notice of that question. I can't remember. I don't want to give the wrong answer. In the video, there are pictures with the temperature, which might help, but I don't know. I have to think about that. The convection is much more vigorous here in terms of horizontal motion. In terms of its vertical motion, I'm not sure. But, I mean, I think the answer is these, because, look, there's a lot of going on even in the vertical direction here, more than here, I would say. But it's better of judging it by eye. That's a good question. So, yeah. Well, the density contrast is 11 to bottom, a ratio of 11. Density is 11 times greater at the bottom. Polytropic index is 5/3. Now, increase the magnetic field a bit. Well, let's say I increase the magnetic field a lot. Let's keep you in suspense. And you get this, which is much more boring. So this is now a strong field situation. And you can see, particularly at the bottom, it's all really rather regular on a very short horizontal length scale compared to what we saw before. There are no big cells to speak of. The flow is not very vigorous. And the field is concentrated in these little regions. But there's nothing. It's quite clear the magnetic field now is having an important role in determining the scales of convection everywhere. If you looked at that, you would say, yes, that's a uniform sort of picture, no large fluctuations. Yes. Now, the side of the box, it's very strong fields here. I mean, relatively strong. Yellow is stronger than blue. Well, it was when there was only blue and pink. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yes, the table, in principle, goes through to other colors. You don't see much yellow. Yeah, those are very strong. So there is in the centers of strong regions of convergence. You expect strong fields locally. So that's the strong field situation. You've seen the weak field situation. What? if you go on increasing Q, eventually you get periodic solutions which are steady, and then you get nothing at all. That's before you get to this stage. Oh yes, by the time it's linear, it's in agreement with linear theory. But that's not linear. It's non-linear and time-dependent, but much more ordered than what you see for small q, at the same Rayleigh number. Yes, I believe so. Well, it depends on the other parameters too. Yes, you can get subcritical behavior. That's certainly true for any q. There is an r, leads to instability. It is likely for very large q to be subcritical. Yeah. Anyway, this is the intermediate situation. And now I put it to you, gentlemen of the jury, that there are two scales of motion here. You see, on the one hand, these big cells, which are just like what we saw before, and on the other hand, these little cells, which are just like what we saw before in the other picture. And they seem to coexist. You can integrate this for as long as your funds hold out. And the proportion of space occupied by the big cells seems to settle down to some fraction of the total area. They zoom around, they break up a bit. You can see they're sort of partially joined here. Well, they can force out that bit of magnetic field and they join up fully and then they can break up again. It's all very dynamic. They can rush across the computational domain. You'll see a picture in a minute for no apparent reason. They come in at this corner and exit at this corner. I don't know why. But here things are much less exciting, as you can see. It's just stronger fields, I mean more uniform fields, and less vigorous convection on a smaller scale. You can see the difference at the bottom too. You see this small scale cellular structure, but here it's all quite different, much more vigorous, and the field has been removed more or less, except from little bits here and there. And I've got a black and white picture which is perhaps even more compelling of the same thing. So here it's even clearer that there are a large fraction of the area is occupied by small-scale convection. It is time-dependent, and here you have a big cell, a couple of big cells, which are obviously of a different nature. So the first question to ask is: Is this the real a real phenomenon, or is it just a load of garbage that you get from not integrating for long enough? Well, we think it's real. Let's show you this picture. So this plots, what you do is you integrate for a while until you think the thing has settled down, and you then calculate the area of the top, the percentage of that area, where B is less than some critical cutoff, which you can select as you wish. And so if you have, if you have small q, you expect large-scale flows and not very much field except in thin interstitial regions, whereas you have large Q, have unvigorous convection, and Q will be B will be almost uniform. So that's the ultimate limit where there's nothing going on. So up here, there's no doubt that we have big cells everywhere. And as you can then increase Q, and the proportion goes down of big cells until you finally end up with a situation where there are no big cells, all little cells. Then if you come back in the other direction, then you have hysteresis, quite considerable hysteresis. If you then decrease Q and start from the previous one, then it takes quite a while, the reduction of Q, for the curve to close on itself. So you have a hysteretic interaction between these two kinds of convection, namely big cells and little cells. So this is not an uncommon phenomenon in if you have two different kinds of convection which are both stable in some sense. They're stable in a little layer, or if you keep the conditions homogeneous, but they can be destabilized by inserting a large enough perturbation of another kind of motion, which is also stable in some sense. We can understand it much better when both these forms of convection are linearly are steady, and you can imagine a situation. Is this easy to put up just for a moment? What's that? No. Here? Which one? There are many switches. If I push this one, do I rise into the air? No. Nothing. Go away. All right. I can't do it. It's no good. Oh, this one. Do not put screen up all the way. Yes. There we go. Thank you very much. I'll just take a very simple. How about white chalk? Simple example. Suppose I have some bifurcation process which leads to cellular motion, which is subcritical. So I'm now plotting the amplitude of motion against some parameter. Suppose I have a subcritical bifurcation. Then, in this region here, there are two uniform stable solutions. This is stable, and this is stable. And the question is, what happens if you introduce a bit of one of these solutions, which are both linearly stable, into the other? And the answer is, you get a front forming. So in some of the domain, A will be very small. In other parts of the domain, A will look like the original cellular solution you started with. And then you can ask, what is going to happen to the front? And depending on where you are in this regime, the front will either move in one direction so that all the zero A is removed in time, or it will move in the other direction so that eventually A falls to zero everywhere. And there's some intermediate value of mu where you can have a sustained front which separates two forms of motion. So that's very well understood in this extremely simple case. And it may be that we can elaborate such models to try and understand something about that interaction in this case too. But let me just, before I do that, let me I just said something about it here. Two phases of convection. So in some sense, if you have a little box, you can have either of them, because there's no possibility of having a mixture when you have a little box. You either have big cells or you have little cells, and they can both be stable. And we're familiar with the idea of droplets forming in material of a different phase. Of course, it's a very imperfect analogy here. Everything is highly time-dependent, turbulence, and you can't say where the front is. But as I said to you, there does seem to be some physics which determines the proportion of the domain which is covered by the big cells. And the fact that there's hysteresis here is also a suggestion that you have some sort of front situation. Now, I want now briefly to talk about another problem which is related to this one. A student at Cambridge, Sean Blanchflower, has done a lot of computations in two and three dimensions for incompressible convection with a magnetic field. So this has nothing to do with the sun, just to understand the role of the magnetic field in pattern formation. And what he's found is that you can find isolated convective solutions in certain regions. So I'm going to show you now an example. This is a two-dimensional simulation. You're just looking across it, up, across. The value of Q is given. There's a fixed Rayleigh number. And here at low Q, you have, this is temperature you're looking at, I think. And these black lines represent the field, the magnetic field, and the closer together the field lines are, the stronger the magnetic field is. Well, there's a small temperature difference which leads to a tiny change in density. It's the usual Boussinesq approximation. Yeah. Heated from below, and you get uniform cells in the presence of a magnetic field. If you now increase the magnetic field, we might expect that the amplitude of this just goes down and it just drops off to zero. But that's not what happens. Well, in fact, what happens is that the aspect ratio of the cells increases, and you get instabilities which lead to a breaking of certain symmetries, and you get wider cells. No, wrong way around, sorry. Narrow, let's think what I'm doing here. In these regions here, there's no motion and strong magnetic field. And this is where the cells are, yeah, in the pink. So as you go on increasing the field, more and more of it wants to be in a motionless state. And eventually, less and less of it is connected to the motion. So this is the end of the process. If you increase Q any more, the thing just drops off to zero. Nothing happens after a while. So what you have here, this is quite remarkable. I agree this is a periodic box, but you'd get essentially the same solution if you doubled the length of this box. And in fact, it's been found. So you have one cell. Here you have two cells counter-rotating, and here you just have one cell. There's been a big change in symmetry between these two. And everywhere else is at rest. Know the temperature difference. So this is a very different solution from the one you started with. And Blanche Clara has called it a convecton. And it's a sort of ultimate form of convection. It's the last thing you could possibly see in a layer as you increase Q. Now, there's clearly an analogy here because you have, obviously, this is linearly stable, this region of uniform field, and this is stable too, in some sense. So you can have a coexistence, and it's perhaps more obvious here, where you have fronts, you have a cellular motion here, and a front, and static motion there. So I just want to put this to you as an interesting analogy with the situation that we have in our model here. It's not, of course, you can't carry through the connection. And this is, for the people who like simple models, here's a simple model. I have to put down some equations. I just wanted to show very simply that it's possible to get a situation where you can have bistability of this kind, and you can also have solutions involving separation which don't depend on the linear stability of the uniform solution. So a very simple model. You can regard this bit of the model as cellular convection. So A is the amplitude of cellular convection, and B is the perturbation to the mean magnetic field. And this has the property that the total amount of perturbation of B is zero. It's a constant, in fact, from this equation, and it is, in fact, zero in this model. So it's an example of a situation where you have a total amount of flux, which you have to push around into various places. You can't get rid of magnetic flux. That's precisely the situation that we're dealing with in our model. Is obviously only in one space dimension. It would work in more. Anyway, it's a crucial parameter delta, which has no physical meaning at this stage. We take it to be bigger than one, otherwise nothing happens. And you can show that there are uniform solutions representing uniform cellular convection, and they can be stable as long as A naught, the amplitude of convection, is large enough. So on the one hand, you can have stable uniform convection. You can also have stable nothing, A equals naught, because mu has to be positive for any convection to occur. But we could look for a solution like this, where some places A is small and some other places A is constant, and there are thin interfacial regions between them. There are two fronts here. So the integral of this green curve ought to be zero. It isn't drawn very well. It has to be positive here and negative here. So this corresponds to weak convection, large field; vigorous convection, small field. And the question is, can these solutions exist? And you can do very simple algebra to show that there is a large range of the parameter mu where you can find solutions of this kind. And this range, interestingly, goes beyond the regions of stability of the uniform solution. So you can find these solutions even when mu is negative, and you can also find them when mu is greater than this critical mu for the stability of the uniform solution. So that the linear stability of the basic state doesn't necessarily control whether or not you possess these interfacial solutions. What else can I show you before I start the video, which I'm going to do in a minute? Let's show you, we have some histograms of the field if you're interested in the variation of the field. That's one for smallish q and one for a larger q. I'm not quite sure what to take away from this. We only found these very recently. The solid lines, this is a probability. So the integral under this curve is 1. Each of these curves is 1. And so you have field strength, vertical field strength, against many boxes, basically, you know, how many bins do you find strength at the field of that particular string. And you can see the scale of these two is not quite the same, because Q is different in each case. This is a stronger field than this, but not by much. And you see there's a sort of popular field strength here, which sort of represents some measure of the amount of compression of the field. We have a fixed amount of flux to begin with, which is normalized to 1 in these pictures. And so the fact that you have a hump here indicates that flux is being concentrated in interstitial regions. And if you work out where B takes this value in space, then you find a network around the cells, as you would expect, and similarly here. On the other hand, in the mid part of the layer, convection is less vigorous, and the preferred size of the field is lower. But I haven't really digested these pictures yet. Okay, well, I want to show you now the video, and then I'll run through some of it quite fast, because it takes 20 minutes. Oh, I want to show you this one more picture. Blanche Flower's calculations, the ones I showed you, were all two-dimensional. And an easy thing to say is, oh, well, of course, this would never happen in three dimensions. But you'd be wrong. So here is a three-dimensional convecton, also found by Blanche Flower. So you're looking now from above. This is from the side, and this is from above. So it's a three-dimensional simulation. And this object here represents, I mean, there are periodic boundary conditions. There's another one here, and another one here, and another one here, another one there. But nonetheless, you can put this more or less anywhere, and it has the same properties. So I don't think the fact that you have periodic boundaries is so important here. This thing has very complicated temporal dependence, but you see it's rather like the one-dimensional convecton. You have a single region of rising fluid, a single region of falling fluid, which you see here, up and down when looked at from the side. This is actually a time-dependent solution. The line here of symmetry or anti-symmetry rotates. But it's quite unusual as a solution of a convection problem. And here you have uniform magnetic field, essentially stationary fluid. It is in fact linearly stable in that area. I know nothing about it. Yeah, at any instant in time, this is the magnetic, not quite sure what that is actually. I think this is the magnetic field strength. This is a very poor picture. I think that there are two bumps here in the field strength. This is temperature you're looking at, this grayscale coding here. So you don't see the magnetic field in these pictures, except perhaps this one, and I'm not quite sure what this picture represents. Yeah, I would expect, yes. They're not very high magnetic Reynolds number, these, but yes, you would. I can't answer that, actually. I didn't do this calculation. Right, the video. I thought it was off before. Oh, I see, that's not. No, what have I done? It's blinking. Yes, do you know how to... Sorry about that, I pressed the wrong button. I meant to bring on the picture. Yeah. Where's Schrödinger? Yeah, but it was on before. Yeah. Yeah, that would be good. Okay, well, we'll let it flash for a little while, and I'll. We could turn down even more of the lights. Or yes, let me try my switches. What's that one doing? Ooh, yes, I like this. Yeah. That one doing anything? Oh yes, here we go. Oh! You have, if you can turn off one or more of the lights. It's gone to red. That must be good.
Okay. Try running something. See if that makes it.
No. Source?
No. Do you have your.
It's in, but it won't. I don't think you'll get anything.
Probably not, but.
Let's sort of.
That would be the other try.
Play.
Yeah.
No, there's no light. Can we have more light, please?
No.
Resize, source. It was working fine before I.
Well,
there's something in there. I can see myself.
Yeah, I know.
Last time it came up very quickly.
Was there a light on the power switch last time?
I can't remember. I mean, it was all just ready to go. I just pressed the wrong button stupidly. I can't believe this. Menu.
No, that doesn't do anything. I'll try it. No.
The tape's running. But is it not on?
Must well, be. It's only a red light. I don't want to fly this in.
I suppose you could try pressing the power button again. Mm-hmm. Yep, that's on. Playing the tape. Yeah, but it comes on before you play the tape. No, wrong one. It's this one.
You had already projected this?
Yes, I've seen it. Yeah.
I'm going to try power button again.
Okay, go for it. Oh, it's green. All right. What can I tell you? What can I tell you? A large coronal mass ejection is approaching Earth. I can tell you that. Ah, right. Okay. So I'll wind it back. Isn't it? Okay, so there's the people who made the video. Actually, Derek Brownjohn made the video. This is our attempt to show that what we are doing is solar physics. Here's a sunspot. There you are. In the old days when we did little boxes. Well, we could be doing something inside a sunspot, or we could be doing something else. But in a sunspot, we certainly have lots of imposed fields. So this is just telling you what I told you before about the color coding. So the side walls are different from the top and bottom. That's the important thing. And the arrows represent the velocity field. The length of the arrows tells you something about the magnitude of the velocity. But they're just projected onto the walls. You don't see any indication. The magnetic field strength in the first of the runs, the second runs, temperature gradient look quite similar. Sigma is 1, I'm sorry, not 0.1. That is 1. Gamma is 5. So here's a large magnetic field. Well, some of these I'll run through on fast forward. Just starts from nothing. Oh, thank you. And the thing settles down quite quickly into essentially steady, not quite steady, but it will, rather dull, steady motion with a sort of broken hexagonal planform. You can see it's pretty steady. A little bit of fiddling around. Now you'll see the same thing again with the temperature gradient instead of the magnetic field strength on the top and bottom. Oh gosh, I'm not sure. Sorry, I'm on flow time. The turnover time. Oh, see, are these numbers? Oh, yes, it's of the order of 10, I think. Okay. You see many turnovers, yeah. So, again, you see very uniform pattern. There's nothing very strange going on there. work very well. That's better. Okay, lower Q. Stop. So it's a bit more time dependent now. But again, I think everybody would agree this is all very small scale stuff. Nothing very. Yeah, there is. Well, the slow magnetoacoustic waves, aka alpha waves, are forced by the convection, can be. So there is a frequency which you can determine. Now this, see, there is some sort of localized instability here, but it doesn't disrupt the cellular pattern at the top, although it is interfering with the symmetry at the bottom. But it doesn't really spread through the domain. And it's all sort of sporadic. You wouldn't say there were domains of different solution there. The two-dimensionality at the bottom, though, is striking compared to the previous picture. This goes on for a little while. Now we see the appearance of the big cells. Which are very. No, it's a different run. Lower Q, I think. 1600, the previous one, this is 1400. But they don't. The big cells don't fill the container. They're not able to. They can't. Having pushed the field out away from themselves, the mean field is stronger away from them, strong enough to stop them developing there. So they can't fill the whole domain. Now you see it again. In terms of the temperature gradient, which is perhaps cleaner, you see cells merge and coalesce and expel the field and become much larger suddenly. Let's see something happening at the bottom too. There it goes. They seem to go together, but I mean, it's hard to make a detailed comparison, as you can see, because the topologies are so very different. But at the same time that those big cells are forming at the top, you saw very strong fields forming at the bottom, where they're less dynamically. You can have much stronger fields at the bottom. Density is much higher. The magnetic field at the same strength has less effect at the bottom of the layer. Yes. Well, it is. I mean, it's more viscous in the new sense, but equally viscous in the mu sense. And you can take your pick as to what that means. I don't have a good intuition. See, nice sort of vortices propagating away from the cells. There's one going across there. So this is the same Q as the previous one, but started from zero velocity. So you get a very similar picture. Q equals 1400 for this particular run, set of runs, is the sort of joining of the hysteresis curve. So you get a similar picture wherever you start from. I didn't say. I think it's 128 squared in the horizontal, 64 in the vertical. It's spectral in the horizontal. Fourth order finite differences in the vertical. We had done some runs with higher resolution, just to check that what is going on has nothing to do with the resolution. That's the same. I think there are. It's clear that the magnetic field just keeps trying to break the cells up, and it's just. There are inhomogeneities in the magnetic field within the cells which come in and sort of break the cell. You wouldn't see it quite the same way, would you? But there are definitely inhomogeneities in these big cells. They're not uniform structure. Yes. Yes, I think that's the arrows. Yeah, that's the arrow. Yeah. This is, we're going up again now, so this is perhaps less interesting. So having got down to Q is 1400, which is the joining of the hysteresis loop, we're now increasing Q again. We expect more big cells for fixed Q than we did before. It's actually almost better in fast motion, but it may be. Q is now being increased from the previous run rather than being decreased, that's all. The white stuff is lots of arrows. So where you see a lot of white, it's very vigorous horizontal motion. But these things move around. This one is sort of just migrates across the layer. This is the one I was talking about. Yeah. Mm. Yes. Well, the very large horizontal velocities, and they churn abruptly and become almost vertical. It's a very sharp interface compared to the width of the cell. You can see a lot of vorticity being generated where the flow is convergent. There's no mean vorticity, of course, in this, but a lot of local vorticity. You see that the weak field situation is also time dependent, but in quite a different way. It's essentially these blobs blobbing up and down, such as you saw in the pictures for larger Q. And then this thing just zooms away. Why does it do that? I don't know. Leaving a sort of wake behind it. We haven't really started to do that in detail. I'll do this one more, and then I'll... Not much more. This is QS 2000. At this stage, you shouldn't be seeing these big cells anymore. And indeed, if I recall, they disappear. We're now going up in the hysteresis. I can't remember whether they actually disappear completely in this one. But they're pretty low. Just one little cell. One little big cell, I mean. I'm afraid I don't know what the algorithm is that selects where the ends of the arrows are, which of course has an influence on what you see. Now this is where it all dies away. I'll do it fast. It's gone. And no more big cells. This can't sustain itself anymore, and it settles down to this simple pattern. Oh, these are... I'll just go right through to the end fast. These are... I don't know why these are here. It's much smaller Q. I think we were trying to understand what happened as Q was reduced. Get many more big cells. Again, we get large cells. Essentially, everything is large here. There's very little small-scale convection. And then finally we do one run for very low Q with much higher resolution, which gives similar features. Double resolution now. You can see the field in the interstices are just big cells basically wiggling around. And that was it. A daft video production. So, if I can have a light, please. Oh. No, you know how to do now. Press that one. Yeah. Well, what are my conclusions? Having seen the video, you've seen almost everything I've seen. I hope you'll agree that there is something different here. This isn't just a selection of scales. There's a competition between two different sorts of motion, and it's in some way associated with bistability. There are other problems which are similar, like this convecton problem, which is in fact a similar problem but at much more constrained way, at lower Rayleigh number, not turbulent flows. Maybe such considerations have something to say about why you see small-scale intermittent fields in some places and large-scale strong fields in others, but I wouldn't like to press the analogy too far. Thank you very much. George. Yeah. Is this turbulence? I would say it was turbulence. Magnetic Reynolds numbers in the hundreds. It's not very turbulent, but it's certainly. I haven't checked. We haven't looked at it in that sort of way, but we could do. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, it's very diffusive. It's not very dramatically turbulent, but I think it's what most people would call turbulent convection. Yes. No, I. You mean with the Blanche-Clark calculations?
Yes.
No. What I said was that if you, this is a periodic situation, so you can take this solution and put it somewhere else, and then continue the computation. It looks more or less the same. No mean velocity. What it actually does, it's very difficult to describe, but it's periodic in time. At any one place, any one spot in space, it's periodic in time. But it isn't that this thing just switches over like that. It doesn't do that. The line of zero horizontal flow, this line here, rotates in space. So it's very complicated from an Eulerian point of view. It has a sort of rotating, oscillating cell. So if you rotate at the right speed, it looks almost steady. But if you're sitting on the ground, it looks periodic. Indeed. Yeah, but he hasn't done that. He's finished his thesis and he's sold his soul to industry. I don't think we're going to see much more, unfortunately. Yes, kid. Yes. Well, now that's a very interesting question, which there have been some computations by, well, the Blanche-Clark stuff, yes. This is all incompressible. Catania has done some simulations, high resolution, big boxes, Boussinesq, magnetoconvection, and so far he hasn't seen this. Now, yes, he's put some field on. Most of it is just the dynamo calculation. I think that I haven't seen his most recent work. Nigel Weiss has discussed it with him, and I think Nigel's view is that the answer is not known in the sense that the two calculations are not comparable. It may be, I mean, obviously the compressibility is obviously important here. This lengthening of the horizontal scale without a magnetic field appears to be an effect of compressibility and maybe is some special feature of the particular parameters that we've adopted, the constant mu and so on. I don't know the answer to that. Well, you could make the layer, yes, you could. You could just make the layer shallower. Yes, you could. Yes, you could certainly do that. Yes. It's just that this takes, each run that you see takes many days on a supercomputer, and we're running out of money. So we have to be very careful with what we do. Yes, Leon. Yes. 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 Arthur. Was that Arthur? That's possible. I'm trying to think what he did. Yes, I mean, some of this stuff, actually, if you look at Nigel's early papers in the 80s, you see pictures a bit like this. Of course, they weren't in color then. But Blanche-Flower unaccountably failed to refer to his supervisor, Weiss's 1981 paper, when he submitted his own paper for publication. And there are some similarities, actually. He got a short and sharp rebuke from the referee. this has been seen in primitive form, because, you know, resolution was so poor in those days in early computations and bytes. But Blanchard's actually done something much more systematic. It is much harder to find these structures in three dimensions. Blanchard had to work extremely hard to find anything in three dimensions. But they do exist, is the point. I mean, they can be found. I don't know whether they're typical or not. Again. I wouldn't say that was entirely true. There are certain topological statements you can make about axisymmetric situation which are different. But you saw what we... Well, we don't do the ready to transfer bit here. Yeah, no. Heat is supplied at uniform temperature at the bottom. Uniform temperature, not heat, not uniform flux. Although I don't think it would matter much if we did supply a flux. No. Heat is supplied and it goes out the top. So that bit of the atmosphere doesn't get hotter or colder. In total. Yes. Oh yes. Yes, that's certainly true. Yes, but not locally, by any means. Yes. Yes, it is. It must carry the same total flux in a steady state. Oh, no, you don't impose the flux. What I'm saying is that flux in equals flux out, of course, in the steady state. Yes, yes. But the flux looks after itself. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think this is a very important question, and probably it would make a big difference, and I would like to do that. Yes, I agree with you. Yeah. I mean, whether it would make... It would make a huge difference to the numbers, whether you could still see the phenomenon. I would hope that that's still possible, but I... Yeah. I know. That's true. Yeah. Any further? That's good. Well, thank you very much.